Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, in Washington today, all eyes are on the Senate, where the battle over judicial nominees has been joined. This morning, two of President Bush's most controversial picks for the federal bench were confirmed in committee, and Democrats are vowing to follow through with threats to filibuster those nominees when their names reach the floor of the Senate. In response, Senate Majority Leader and likely presidential candidate Bill Frist has said he might trigger the so-called nuclear option, changing Senate rules to skirt the filibuster and allow a simple majority of senators to confirm judges. Well, for the latest on judges and more, we're joined by Gail Shattuck. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, tell us first, who are these two judges who passed in committee today?
Priscilla Owen, a nominee for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, and Janice Rogers Brown, a nominee for the District of Columbia Circuit.
And both were filibustered last year?
Yes. No, but Priscilla Owen has been around for almost 4 years now. She was part of President Bush's first list of nominees back in May 2001. So there is nothing that isn't known about these two candidates. They have been very thoroughly vetted at this point.
Right. And Democrats are saying they're far too ideological. Correct?
I'm sorry.
Democrats are saying they're far too ideological.
Too extreme for the Fed for a lifetime appointment.
Right.
That's the point on both of them.
Republicans countering that Democrats' opposition to these two women makes Democrats anti-black. Janice Rogers Brown is an African-American, anti-female. But do Republicans led by Frist have the votes to change the Senate rules on the Democrat form of protest or filibuster?
Well, that, of course, is a $60,000 question. I have heard comments as recently as 10 minutes ago from Republicans saying, yes, we have the votes. Democrats claim they do not. My own sense is that until this battle is thoroughly engaged, we're not going to know that. The concern here isn't just moderate Republicans who have already said they have doubts about going to the nuclear option. It's also traditionalists. People like Senator Warner, who have been here for a long time and know that a majority can become a minority and may be reluctant to change the rules in this way. We won't know literally until the moment this goes to the floor for a vote.
Well, in fact, it's called the nuclear option because it's so, you know, potentially politically explosive. And do we understand that it's Senator Frist who will decide? And do we have any sense of how he will decide?
Well, he has said that he wants to exhaust every possible option. There are members of his party also running for president in 2008, Senator Allen, for example, who've been pressing him to do this even last year. And the fact that he's held out this long suggests that he doesn't have the votes yet and that he really wants to be seen to be exhausting every option. He's also under a lot of pressure from the business wing of the Republican Party, who wants to see things like the highway bill, tort reform, a budget, get through the Senate before the place breaks down, which is what Democrats say is going to happen. So he's got this. There is no more important decision for him than this one, and there's a lot of cross pressures.
Right, and the additional pressure that he is considered a presidential candidate in the future as well. Well, another hot issue in the Senate, whether to confirm controversial nominee John Bolton as U.N. ambassador. A vote on his nomination was delayed this week. This morning, the president called Bolton the right man at the right time. But what are the prospects now for a nomination that seemed like a sure thing last week?
Well, there's a kind of iron law in Washington that confirmation delayed is often confirmation denied. If you look at what happened to John Tower when he, back in 1989, he was a former senator nominated to be defense secretary, and it looked like a sure thing. But with each delay, it increased this cycle of more allegations, more investigation, more allegations, and so forth. And at the end, the nomination sank. And that, I think, is what you're seeing here. With another 3 weeks, anyone that has ever had a concern about an extremely irascible personality now has an incentive to come forward. And I think there are Republicans who are already saying that this nomination, if not already sunk, is going to have very great difficulty. And without the president investing a great deal, it's not going to go forward.
Gail Shattuck is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor on the Hill today. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
This week marks the 6th anniversary of the Columbine School tragedy, two students killing 13 people before taking their own lives. Since that day, school districts have been working to ensure student and teacher safety, and we'll have more on that in a moment. But recently, there's been an increase in another type of violence, parent versus teacher. This month, a father in Tyler, Texas, allegedly shot his son's high school football coach in the chest. That coach is recovering, but is in serious condition. And recently, police say a mother in Dallas attacked a teacher. It turns out that mother is also a teacher. She was charged with assault and placed on administrative leave. Mary Oliver was the teacher allegedly attacked. She joins us now on the line. And Mary, what do you allege happened? Were you in your class? Were students there?
I was in the middle of my third period class, and yes, I did have students. I was sitting at my desk, and Mrs. Baines entered my classroom, crossed my classroom in between my students and their desks, and came round to me. I was sitting down, and she said that I had embarrassed her daughter in the hallway and that she was going to beat me up, and then proceeded to do so in front of my students.
What are you alleging that she did?
Well, she grabbed my hair, started punching me on my face several times, pulled me off my chair, dragged me through my classroom by my hair, and during this process continued to punch me on my face and kick me about my back and ribs and midsection.
Did she say anything while she was doing this?
She continued to say that she was going to beat me up.
And by the way, what are your students saying about this? You allege that they watched this attack.
They were. They were in the classroom. Some of the students tried to intervene while others ran for help. I can only imagine how horrified it must have been for them. I know that they were counseled at the school. I know that several of them spent several days crying.
Well, now, Paulette Baines has not made any comments since then. She has been arrested, charged with assault, as we said, and this will obviously be adjudicated. But in the meantime, how much of a surprise was this to you?
I was very surprised. Like I said, I was in the middle of my class. Her daughter was not a student of mine. Her daughter was of a group of students that I had addressed earlier that they needed to get to class. So I was very, very surprised.
Do you feel that you were improper in the way you spoke to her daughter?
No, I do not feel that. I just said, y'all need to get to class.
Do you think, Mary, that this was just an isolated incident?
I would like to think it was an isolated incident. I would not like to think that this is a trend or an ongoing problem at our school.
And by the way, how are you feeling right now?
I'm very sore. There is constant pain because I have two broken ribs. I did suffer a concussion. I had bruises and cuts and scratches along my face and my neck and all around my head. Most of the bruising has gone away. It's starting to fade, but the broken ribs will take 6 to 8 weeks to heal.
What would you like to see the school do because of this incident? Is there anything that the school can or should do?
Well, because she was a teacher, she had proper identification when she entered the building. My school is a very small school. It's for talented and gifted students in downtown Dallas. We are a tremendously successful school. We have terrific parental involvement. And I would like to somehow just restore the confidence in our school, restore the children's sense of safety, restore the parents' confidence in our school.
Mary Oliver is a teacher at the Travis Academy in Dallas, Texas. She was allegedly attacked by a parent in her classroom. That parent's also a teacher at another school in the system. Mary, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And as we said, Paulette Baines has not spoken publicly about these allegations, and she didn't return our calls for a response. And again, while incidents like this one are rare, some experts are saying it is a trend. Aggressive behavior toward teachers is happening more often. Joining us on the line is Dr. Chuck Jaksek. He's a school social worker in Hillsborough County, Florida, and author of the book, The Confrontational Parent. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good. And I know that you did research into this topic of parents assaulting teachers. What'd you find?
There's a lot of, I think, verbal abuse, harassment, intimidation, and threats that are being perpetrated toward our school personnel, especially school administrators.
You did some studies?
Yes, ma'am. I did two of them. One in our school district, which is now almost the largest, ninth largest school district in America. And the other one, I basically used every county in the state of Florida, 67 counties.
What are some of the things you've seen?
Well, interestingly, we found out that over 71% of the school administrators had received a threat by parents or guardians to contact other authorities. Also, we found out that about 50% of the respondents reported that shouting or profanity was directed at them by a parent during the school year.
And it gets obviously much more serious than that.
Yes, and I've had many instances where I've had the opportunity to speak around the country, and some of the stories are just unbelievable. California, we had a superintendent that was actually tied up and taken by a parent because they disagreed with the disciplinary policy of the county, and luckily the sheriff found them about 10 miles down the road.
Why is it happening? I mean, again, we've rushed to point out that most administrators are saying that most parents have a terrific relationship with teachers, but there is this increase in these attacks. Why?
The one point I do want to stress that 99% of those parents out there are wonderful parents. Schools have to have parents. You have to have them. And most of them are very, very cooperative. It's that small percentage that can cause a lot of stress for our school personnel. Now you say, why? It could be any kind of stresses put on the family. It could be the parents' experiences as a child when they were coming up through. If they didn't like a principal or their teachers, or they had failures in school, chances are maybe they're carrying some of that attitude to our schools. And also, maybe it's the school personnel. Some of them could be better communicators. You know, when I've talked to the parents, I've had principals say, you know, Chuck, the one complaint that we get from parents is you people don't hear what we're saying. You're not listening to what we're saying. You act like you do, but you don't. The other thing is school personnel say we could take hassles from kids. They're kids. They don't know any better. But to have a 40-year-old or 50-year-old person come in here highly educated and talk to us like we're nothing, we have a hard time with that.
So what are educators doing? What are some of the things that they're doing?
What I tend to teach my school administrators is trying to diffuse. Think of a balloon that's blown up and it's going to pop. That would be the parent's anger. About 70% of that balloon could be deflated by the time you actually sit down with them to start a conference. And little things like, first of all, before you go out to meet a parent who may be irate or dangerous, recognize the potential for a dangerous situation. Have your secretary come back and say, you know, Chuck, this person could be dangerous. What they're wearing, are they concealing a weapon? How do they seem like they've been drinking? In other words, don't rush out there to engage a parent. Number two, assess your ability to deal with it, whether you had an argument with your wife, if you have medical problems, any kind of problems. You may come into work a little bit stressed, and then when you're meeting a person who also is stressed, that's not a good combination. Third thing is to identify advantages. When I tell my people, when you sit down with a parent, have someone with you, keep the door open, sit by the door, little things that we often just neglect and we don't have to neglect. And finally, diffuse the parent before you actually sit down and say a word to them. As you approach them, don't walk up like you're intimidated, but don't walk up like you're a bully. Extend your hand. Say thank you for coming in, even if they demanded that they come in.
Dr. Chuck Jaksek, school social worker in Hillsborough County, Florida, and author of the book, The Confrontational Parent. Dr. Jaksek, thank you.
Thank you.
So, parents, teachers, administrators, what do you think? As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Just ahead, we'll continue our look at schools and find out about a program that hands out cash to students who will turn in their peers. Now, and today we've been talking about the safety of teachers and students. 6 years after the Columbine tragedy, violence in schools is still a very real threat. Last month, as we all know, a student allegedly killed 7 people at a school in Red Lake, Minnesota. Many schools have responded by starting up programs that pay students to turn in classmates who carry guns or drugs or, in other ways, just break the rules. Joining us on the line is Larry Wieda, a former police officer from Boulder, Colorado. He started the Scholastic Crime Stoppers program. And, Larry, tell us first, exactly how does this program work?
Basically, the program is designed to help students get information out as to what's going on inside the confines of the school. It's designed like a Crime Stopper program where the young people have an opportunity either to report the information to an administrative advisor inside the confines of the school or to the outside parent Crime Stopper program in their community or general proximity. It guarantees the anonymity of the informant. Anybody, a student, teacher, administrator, anybody within confines of the school. The kids stay anonymous. They have an opportunity, again, to report the information.
And so tell us, roughly how much are they paid, and what are some of the activities that they're snitching about?
Our program was designed basically not to pay more than $100, and we didn't want the kids running around with a lot of cash and bragging or someone implying that they were being snitching. And that's probably a bad choice of words. They're not snitching. They're being good citizens. They're doing what we expect our parents or mom and dad to do in the past, is to keep our community safe and give information.
Well, you know that some schools are calling, you know, have dubbed them snitch programs, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That. And there is a concern that no matter how hard you try to keep anonymity, you know, the kids might talk about receiving money and you know, they might be found out. Has there been any retribution against students who take part in the program?
The 22 years that the program has been operating, I only know of two cases where students who gave information actually got themselves in trouble. And the reason for that is they started bragging about the reward that they had received.
Mm-hmm.
So that's two out of over 3,000 programs we got set up around the world that we know of. That's pretty good odds.
What are some of the things that the kids are telling about?
Well, you know, most parents, unfortunately, and communities believe that there's no crime in our schools, or there's no guns, there's no drugs, there's no criminal activity. But when you actually get involved and start running one of these programs, everything that goes on in our community is happening inside the schools. Drugs being sold, weapons, sexual assault, every crime that's committed in the community is being committed on most of our campuses throughout the United States.
I'm reading one report in Texas. The Carrollton Farmers Branch Independent School District there has the program. They say that during the 2003-04 school year, they collected 11 weapons because of tips.
That's one of the benefits of the programs. It does really work extremely well with firearms or knives or any type of other devices that the kids may be bringing to school to create some situations or problems or injure each other.
Well, but I'm also reading that there's a program at Cherryville High School in Gaston County, North Carolina, and the principal there says it's been very successful. But he goes on to say, you know, for $100, these kids will turn their mothers in. How do you trust the tipster?
You take the piece of information, and that's what it is. It's a piece of information about a criminal act that may have been committed. And you do the investigation, whether that be the inside the confines of the school by the school administration or the local law enforcement school resource officer that may be assigned to the school, follows up on that tip, and nothing is actually charged until the case is actually resolved and the information is verified one way or the other. If it happens any other way, then they're not running the program as it was designed to do.
Well, Larry, it seems to some like a tightrope that you're walking here, because from kindergarten on up, kids are told not to be tattletales.
Right.
You know, not to tell on their friends. And now
Right.
This program is encouraging them to do that.
Well, everything has changed drastically, where you have to rely on the people standing up and taking the initiative to be involved in the community. I don't think we would have the problems we have today if everybody was paying attention as to what is really going on and willing to step forward. So Crime Stoppers gives them that opportunity and also gives them the opportunity to stay anonymous, which is their choice. And if they choose to identify themselves, then they themselves put themselves in harm's way.
Yeah.
The program is designed to protect the individual if they're willing to come forward.
As you know, some schools are giving out $500, $1,000. Do you worry that the money might escalate?
And that's true. And when I designed the program, the reason that we kept it at $100 was just for that sole purpose, that not to give the implication that you could sell, you know, you sell your soul, basically, for the price tag. And that's what we try and impress on the students and the parents, that this is not a money-making scheme. We're not giving the kids money to buy drugs or any other items. A lot of the programs are set up where they work with the business community and they get gift certificates for clothing or other things that may be important to the young people. So it's not necessarily a cash type deal. It depends on how the program is set up and proceed within the community.
Well, Larry Rita, I know you believe passionately in this Scholastic Crime Stoppers program. Do you think that anywhere along the way in the last 23 years you've stopped another Columbine?
I'd like to believe that we did. I know for a fact that there are several situations. As a matter of fact, I did a program in Rochester, New York, where a Crime Stopper program was set up in the school a week after I had left. We put it all together, and there was a disgruntled boyfriend who was going to shoot his girlfriend and her new boyfriend. And it came in on a Crime Stopper tip, and the SWAT team came in about maybe 45 seconds before the trigger was being pulled. So I know that case, in actuality, did get solved because of the Crime Stopper tip.
And got prevented. Larry Wieda, former Boulder police officer. He created the Scholastic Crime Stoppers program. Larry, thanks for telling us about it.
Well, you're quite welcome, and I hope that can be assistance to any community that's willing to start the program.
And for more information about Scholastic Crime Stoppers, visit our website, here-now.org. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, Syria is expected to pull all of its troops out of Lebanon by month's end. We'll look at what that means for the balance of power in Damascus. And the nation's largest teachers union files suit against the U.S. Secretary of Education, claiming the No Child Left Behind law is reform without resources. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger apologized yesterday for telling a group of newspaper publishers in San Francisco that the U.S. should close the border with Mexico. The governor later said he meant secure the border. The comments are likely to be used as ammunition by the governor's expanding chorus of critics. Last year, Schwarzenegger enjoyed a series of political successes and high approval ratings, even though he inherited a huge budget deficit from Governor Gray Davis. Schwarzenegger defeated Davis in the 2002 recall election. Well, now, is the honeymoon over for the governor? Elizabeth Garrett is the director of the University of Southern California Caltech Center for the Study of Law and Politics. She spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Elizabeth, the governor has met with some resistance recently to some of his initiatives there. Tell us about that. Which ones is he having trouble with?
He's met with a great deal of resistance to the initiatives that he suggested in his State of the State address in January. Most significantly, he had to withdraw his proposal to reform the state's pension program. He wanted to change from what is now really a defined benefit program to a defined contribution, sort of like the 401ks or 403bs that many Americans have. But this government program is very different here in California. He wanted to reform it. He met with so much opposition that he had to withdraw the initiative, says he'll keep working on it. One reason he got a lot of opposition is that when the initiative came out, it was summarized by the Attorney General's office as eliminating death and disability benefits for firefighters, policemen. That received a great deal of very negative publicity and really ginned up the opposition.
There were widows of public safety officers, police officers, firefighters who actually picketed, weren't there?
Oh, yeah, and the airwaves were full of ads with those people talking about their dead spouses and how important the disability and death benefits were to them. It was really a disastrous misstep by Schwarzenegger. He also proposed in January budget reform. He also wants to reform education, most notably to go to a merit pay system rather than a pay system based on seniority. That's being actively opposed by teachers' unions. And finally, he proposed redistricting to change the way we draw the districts for state legislature and for the House of Representatives. And not surprisingly, that's meeting opposition from the current politicians.
What's changed in relation to his relationship with Democrats in California? Initially, they were working together. And though the relationship might not necessarily have been warm, at least it was cordial. But now it's much less so.
Well, I think what's changed is that he's proposing initiatives that are facing a great deal of opposition, and opposition from groups that are strong within the Democratic Party and that are also pretty sympathetic with voters. You know, when he came out with his big bond in March of last year, nobody opposed him. In November, his big initiatives were against gambling interests. Well, those are not very popular interests with Democrats or Republicans. But now he's taking on government workers, teachers, education system as it is, Democrats, and frankly, some incumbent Republicans. And I think that is one of the changes in the relationship. It's also the case that he's now seen as more partisan because of the opposition of these largely Democratic groups. He's now increasingly being portrayed as very closely aligned with certain special interests like financial institutions, insurance industry, healthcare, sort of business interests. And his popularity is declining. Before January, his popularity was in the low 60s. It's now under 50%, still higher than the legislature, but still a decline for the governor.
So when one of his consultants, his Republican consultants, is quoted as saying, this is a governor who is incredibly popular within his own party, got pretty good support with independents, and still has a reservoir of support from Democrats, that's not entirely accurate.
Well, I think you have to be careful not to overstate the decline in his popularity. He is still a very popular politician in the state, and relative to the legislature, he is still very popular. But his support is eroding generally, and it is eroding more quickly among Democrats. And so I think he can't be as confident of his broad base of support as he was, say, after the November election.
Does Governor Schwarzenegger still stand a chance of being able to follow through on his quote-unquote year of reform promises at this point?
Well, I think what he needs to do is to really decide what are the most important initiatives to him and to focus his firepower on those. If I were advising him, I would advise him to focus on the budget initiative, because the real challenge for California is our structural deficit. And Schwarzenegger's proposal is one way to go about that. It is a way that does not include increased revenues, which I think probably means it can't be an entirely successful strategy.
Let me move back to party politics, if I can, for a moment. Some Democrats are blaming Governor Schwarzenegger's current problems on their perception that he's beginning to pander to the far right.
Well, I'm not sure that I think that that's accurate. It is certainly the case that he is taking positions that are more clearly contrary to the interests of groups that have been very important to the Democratic Party, such as state employee groups, teachers, firefighters. You know, these are all traditional groups that have strongly supported the Democrat. Education has always been an issue that is mainly a Democratic issue. And I do think that the press, which has been following all the money that's been flowing to Arnold Schwarzenegger's various political committees, has really been emphasizing the tone of that money. And that money tends to come mainly from business. It comes from the health industry, from the insurance industry, from real estate developers, from the very wealthy. So he is increasingly seen, and I think somewhat accurately, as more to the right than a person who spans both parties. But he has certainly not taken a turn to the far right on social issues and other issues that one associates with at least the National Republican Party.
Well, he did inflame that debate, though, with his recent comments in which he suggested that California close the border with Mexico in order to control illegal immigration, and then later having to apologize for that after the furor broke out, saying that he misspoke because he had a language problem.
Yeah, and I think that also points up how he really needs to keep his focus on what he wants to accomplish this year. That kind of a statement, which was, I thought, ill-advised and showed that he was speaking before he'd really thought about it, or one hopes. I mean, that's what he said when he apologized. It shows that he hasn't kept his focus on what he needs to get done if he wants his initiatives to get through. He cannot afford to have debates opening up on other hot-button issues that aren't part of his main agenda right now. It'll divert his attention from what he needs to get done, and it will weaken him in the political realm, because people will have more questions about whether he really is a centrist, whether he's somebody who represents all Californians rather than just an element of California.
Elizabeth Garrett, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Garrett is the director of the University of California Caltech Center for the Study of Law and Politics. She spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Well, still to come, we'll meet four students who beat all sorts of odds to win a national engineering competition. You're listening to Here Now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. And many of you wrote after this week's interview with New York Daily News columnist Michael Goodwin. He was critical of former President Bill Clinton's comment that Republican operative Arthur Finkelstein might suffer self-loathing since he both ran anti-gay rights political campaigns and, it was recently revealed, had a gay marriage. Columnist Goodwin suggested that Clinton meant that all gay Republicans were self-loathing. Don Byrd, a therapist, listened while he tried to do a plumbing project, and he wrote, "Self-loathing is not about one's sexual preference. Clinically, it refers to any situation in which one's actions are in direct conflict with one's beliefs. My belief that a male homeowner should be able to fix a clogged bathroom sink was in direct conflict with my total lack of ability to do the same. I imagine that a gay Republican who campaigns against homosexuality has to be full of self-loathing because of the conflict between belief and action, not the nature of the belief or the nature of the action. Ironically, Bill Clinton is the poster boy of self-loathing, as are most successful modern politicians, because of what you have to do and say to get elected. P.S. As I mulled this letter over in my head, my male nanosites kicked in, and I successfully and neatly finished my plumbing job." Well, our coverage of the death and funeral of Pope John Paul II, along with other coverage about the role of religion in public policy, prompted Lydia Breen of New Orleans, Louisiana, to write, and so we thought we'd call her. Lydia, what were your concerns?
Well, I felt like that there were just too many stories. It seemed like every place you turn, not just on NPR, but all over, there are stories with a religious theme. And I was hoping for a little bit better with NPR. I am a practicing Christian myself, but I don't feel like I need to have my spiritual side fed by NPR.
And what did you think? Why did you think it was happening that these stories were being done?
Well, I think that, in my opinion, after the election, the last presidential election, it seemed like the media felt like they got it wrong, that they misjudged the American character, that people were much more religious than they thought. So to compensate, they would give them a lot more religious stories.
Well, and we've had email exchanges on this. You know, our thought is that when stories cross over into public policy issues, for instance, whether or not the Ten Commandments should be in courthouses, we feel we should cover it. And there are a lot of people who don't think they should cede religious issues to the right.
Yes, I think that's true, but I think we have to be very careful that these issues are a way to stir people up and to make a connection between Christianity and right-wing politics.
You mean you worry that they might become propaganda?
Yes. I mean, even the Pope story, let's face it, it's good PR for the Catholic Church. It's an important story, and it should be covered, but I think we should also see that it's good PR for the Catholic Church.
Steve Horan of Portsmouth, Rhode Island, wrote, after our conversation with filmmaker Greg Spatz, whose documentary American Jobs takes a dim view of outsourcing, Steve writes, "There's a big picture that appears to be somewhat overlooked. We all know that poverty and joblessness in the third world produces discontent and breeds a terrorist mentality. Isn't it possible that all this outsourcing is helping to slowly eliminate those feelings of discontent? We just have to create new job markets at home for the displaced workers who are democratizing the world through their job loss." After our feature on ultra-marathoner Dean Karnazes, we heard from Linda Brewer of Tucson, Arizona. She says, "My running buddy Pam Reed has already achieved the goal of running 300 miles without stopping. She did her 300-mile run over Easter weekend in a little less than 80 hours. Dean is a superb athlete, but so is Pam. Give her a mention at least." So there you go. And we heard from many of you after our report on the NBC series Revelations. K.O. Myers of Philadelphia wrote, "You said the miniseries is based on the New Testament book of Revelations. The title of the final book is singular, The Revelation of St. John. One saint, one revelation. You wouldn't say that the Ten Commandments was based on Exoduses, would you?" Mea culpa. By the way, many of you also asked, what was the music we played from that program? Well, the song is called All for Believing. It's by the Australian singer-songwriter Missy Higgins.
I'm all for believing, I'm all for believing. I need to know just how you feel.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. And now, four public high school students from West Phoenix, Arizona, have surprised the engineering world and themselves by taking top honors at the National Underwater Robot Championship. They beat out teams from MIT and other colleges and high schools, many of them sponsored by major corporations. The Arizona students won with a relatively inexpensive $800 robot built from PVC pipes. They come from families struggling economically, and they are all illegal immigrants. Josh Davis wrote about the competition this month for Wired magazine 6 months after their win. The team was made up of Lorenzo Santillan, Christian Arcega, both juniors at Carl Hayden High School, and Luis Aranda and Oscar Vasquez, who've since graduated. And all four of them join us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona, along with one of their teachers, Fred Legvardi. Christian, I want to start with you. I understand you used glue to hold your robot together, and that created quite an odor, so you named him Stinky.
Yeah, that's correct. It smells really bad.
Well, can you describe him for us and, you know, how'd you come up with some of the thinking behind him?
Well, basically, we shared ideas, and that's where we came up with the idea to use PVC. It's inexpensive, and it's easy to put together.
Oscar, could you tell me more a little bit more about what Stinky looked like?
Stinky looked like a cube. He had the PVC pipes on the side. The frames were all PVC pipe. You could see like a briefcase box on top with all the electronics and another briefcase in the bottom with the battery on it. We have four propellers in there to push it up and down and to push it back and forth. Lorenzo painted it blue and then yellow and then red.
Well, Christian, they called you the genius on the team. What kind of skills did you bring?
I like order, so I like things to be be organized.
Lorenzo, dubbed the mechanic, what did you bring to the project?
My skills in building. I actually rebuilt motors with my cousin and my brother, but that was their cars and stuff, so I just learned off what they told me to do.
Let's talk about the competition itself. You get to an Olympic-sized pool at the University of California in Santa Barbara. There's all sorts of other colleges and high schools there. Oscar, you'd been in ROTC since ninth grade, kind of have real leadership qualities, but when you walked in there, what are you thinking?
Well, I saw the competition, and I knew that it was going to be a challenge for us to even place. It was kind of humbling.
Humbling, though. Let's remember that word, because it became a humbling experience for the other schools. But, Luis, do you remember what happened when you lowered Stinky into the pool, the practice pool, when you got to the competition?
We started testing it out. When we took it back out, we saw it was starting to leak, man. We had a few other problems with the controls. They weren't working quite right, so we had to do a little troubleshooting with that.
Oh, in fact, didn't you have to resolder every wire for the next 12 hours?
This is Oscar. Lorenzo and I soldered him until 2 in the morning.
So you spent the night repairing the robot. The next morning you put it back in the water. You must have been holding your breath, but then it did work. Christian, tell us about that.
It was really something because we see all our hard work and everything just starting to pay off. The robot's working fine. You put it into the water and it hasn't blown up or anything. So we know we're going to be operational. And to actually perform in the water the way we were, like the robot was working to our expectations, was really something because you see all your hard work pay off.
Did you feel a sense there that you were not being taken seriously?
Oh, yeah, that came across a lot. I mean, people were polite enough not to say it to our face too many times, but I just ignored it. I figured they don't know what they're talking about us, and comes out we were right.
So the robot completed a series of underwater tasks, you guys working the controls above the pool. Then on to the nerve-wracking award ceremony dinner. Now, to begin, you won a special judges award. First of all, why do you think you won that award?
They're all looking at me. This is Freddie. they didn't explain what it was for other than it was a category that the judges hadn't planned. So we thought that it may have been for the way we used a device to absorb any extra water in our electronics housing.
The darn thing was leaking the night before. So who was it who had to run around and find what to soak up this moisture in the battery?
That was Lorenzo.
Lorenzo. We all volunteered him.
Yep.
I had to get off some tampons that were small. I just went to the lady and asked her what are the best product I could get with the most absorbency, but also small to fit the case.
So you had to be the only underwater robot with a tampon in it in the competition. But it was genius because it absorbed the moisture. It saved the day. And so, Fred, you were saying that you all thought, well, maybe the judges were giving us that nice pat on the head award. But then, as the awards evening went on, You won for design elegance, for technical reporting, and then overall winner. Christian, your thoughts when that was announced?
I was really shocked. I remember we were all dumbstruck, and we were looking at each other, and then we start screaming at the top of our lungs. Remember, I just jump at Louise, and I don't know, I can't remember if he was crying then. But it was really something to be up there holding the first place trophy in front of all the other schools.
It was an incredible success, you know, against wealthier schools, older kids. And in addition, it's been reported that all four of you are illegal immigrants. Christian, did you feel judged by that?
Well, basically, I didn't really care for that label, and I don't really care that I'm undocumented. That's not going to make me perform less than anyone else. Most people didn't think we'd be able to do it. I know my parents wanted me to do well, and they were really cheering for me. But other than that, any people in the community weren't really that ecstatic about us entering this competition.
And Fred, there are some other hard realities about being undocumented. These prizes are usually a ticket to college, but there are efforts underway to prevent undocumented kids from attending state schools. And we understand it's difficult to get aid.
As far as getting any financial aid as federal money is concerned, it's not going to happen because you have to show proof of citizenship or residency. So even though we may have kids that are, you know, capable of achieving at that level, they kind of have to make other life choices because those options aren't open to them.
Well, Christian, you're a high school junior now. Your thoughts about college?
Well, here's the way I see it. I'm not trying to hold any errors, but I know I'm a bright kid, and I'm going to figure out a way to go to college. There's been people that are trying to help us out right at the moment, trying to get us a full tuition scholarships to schools like MIT and Caltech. It's just always been a dream of mine, being the first in my family to go to college and get a career. And if it doesn't work out, I'm sure there are schools in Mexico that would accept me. So I'm going to make it one way or another.
And Oscar?
I want to be a mechanical engineer and hopefully help design electric engines or something like that for future electric cars.
Luis, what do you want to be?
Go to business school or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Try to start my own business.
And Lorenzo, can't leave you out. What do you want to do? What do you want to be?
I'm thinking of being a chef or an engineer. I'm not sure right now.
If there's a will to want to do something, they'll figure out what they need to do. Lorenzo's case, you know, when he came into the program, is basically making D's and F's. And because of what he learned by being in the program and the value and what school really means, he's now an A and B student. Now, if he had done that when he first started, he might be in a little better position. But the motivation is the number one thing. With that, you can do, as you see by the result of this competition, anything you want to do if you just stay focused long enough and hard enough.
So real concerns, but I'm wondering in the meantime, gosh, has Hollywood called?
For 6 to 8 months after we came back, nobody wanted to hear the story. We were dumbfounded then, but now after Josh's article, it's like a whole new rebirth.
A few weeks later, I think, the story was bought by Warner Brothers, and the producer of that is John Wells from ER.
And West Wing.
And West Wing.
Well, there you go. So. Well, it just make sure you get your college tuition out of it.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great story. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Josh Davis's article about the Carl Hayden robotics team from West Phoenix, Arizona, appears in this month's issue of Wired magazine. Meanwhile, the team is gearing up for its next contest, June 17th through 19th at the Johnson Space Center. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin.